Hello there, welcome to this episode of Double Jeopardy, the Law and Politics podcast, with me, Ken MacDonald.
And with me, Tim Owen. And for this final episode of 2023, Ken and I wanted to focus on solicitors and the challenges which face that profession. Our guest to guide us through the issues is the former president of the Law Society, Stephanie Boyce. Stephanie has a remarkable life story. Born to parents who came to the UK from the Caribbean in the 1960s, she began her secondary education in the UK after failing the 11 plus, and then moved with her family to the USA in 1985 to complete her high school education. The day after she graduated from high school at the age of 19, she returned to the UK, determined, even at that stage, to study the law of England and Wales. But her path to qualifying as a solicitor was not a smooth one. She was told, "You don't look or sound like a solicitor," and that her ambition to join a city law firm was unrealistic. But she refused to submit to such bigotry. After a short period in private practice in Huntingdon, Stephanie went in-house at the General Counsel of the Bar, then later at the Association of Chartered Accountants, and after that with Ofsted and the Pensions Regulator, fitting in a master's degree in public law and global governance in between. In 2013, Stephanie joined the Council of the Law Society, and in 2015, she stood, unsuccessfully at first, for the post of Deputy Vice President. After another three goes, she was elected Deputy in 2019, and in 2021, she became the President of the Law Society, leading some 200,000 solicitors in England and Wales. She was the 177th person to hold that office, the sixth woman, and the first person of colour. In one of the many inspiring interviews she's given on YouTube, her motto seems to be, "Never give up, put your head above the parapet." Stephanie, inspiring stuff. Welcome to Double Jeopardy.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks very much for joining us, Stephanie.
Stephanie, I was fascinated looking at, what, as I say, one of the videos in which I think it was the Women in Law First 100 Years video that you gave. You described how your father, who came, I think, at the age of 17 from Barbados, having left education at the age of 12, he always said to you that if he had had the opportunity, he would have gone into law. I mean, when were you aware of that? And what was it that made you decide at the age of 19, while you were in the US, that you wanted to come and study law here?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think it goes back even further than that. And as early as I can remember it, from the age of seven, you know, just seeing what was going on globally and domestically, just the burning desire to just want to enable others to have their voice heard and to contribute my voice to what was going on around the world, where I saw lots of injustices going on, people, lots of protests, people protesting about their rights. But I think the real experience came when I went to America. And I think it's fair to say that America would have a lasting impression upon me. You know, I'd be overwhelmed by the poverty. I'd never seen poverty like that before. So people's inability to access justice because of their low socioeconomic position, because of their rights. And all of that played into, I think, my character, my personality, in as much that I went through high school and every Thursday I was in mourning, I'd dress in black, and I was mourning for the world. And when I had detentions, I had a few of those. When I had detentions, I'd go, you know, with placards and prop them up on the desk. And, you know, they would read things like, you know, "If Mandela is not free, nor are we." I remember, lots of my school friends asking me, "Who is Nelson Mandela?" And so I think it's a contribution of all of that that I saw going on.
Did you perceive differences between the US and Britain? I mean, obviously, Britain had very serious issues of its own, but was America worse? Was the poverty worse? Was the bigotry worse? How did they compare?
Well, absolutely. As I say, America would be an absolute turning point for me. I had never really experienced or known racism until I got to America. And one of my favourite songs by Tracy Chapman, where she sings about "Across the Lines." And I didn't understand what that song meant until I went to America.
By the way, where did you go? Where did you grow up in America? Why did your parents move there?
So my stepfather was in the American Air Force. He was stationed back in America when we first went to upstate New York, Plattsburgh. And we were, the first time we were living on an American base, and I, because we hadn't lived, we'd lived off base in the UK. So that was a completely different world, completely different exposure, coming from rural Buckinghamshire, being thrown into an American way of life. And on the base where you're restricted going in, restricted going out. And, you know, I schooled on the base as well. So the whole life was contained on the base. But also, so my stepfather came out of the Air Force and did a short while. We lived for a short while in North Carolina and then settled eventually in Norristown in Pennsylvania, where I would graduate from high school. But as I say, and as the years evolved and I went back, and of course we had the O.J. Simpson case and so forth, that real demarcation of race, of colour, of rich and poor was absolutely striking. And it still strikes me, having returned in 2022 with the Law Society to Chicago, seeing the extent of homelessness and poverty that still prevails in one of the world's richest countries.
The idea then to study law, you say, had been sort of almost with you from the age of seven. But as I said in the intro, when you did come back here and you started to focus on becoming a lawyer, becoming a solicitor, I think things were not easy. How would you describe those early years?
They were difficult because I was having to navigate my way through a system that and around barriers, over barriers that I didn't even know some of which were there. Some I knew of, some I didn't, in terms of financials, in terms of networks, social networks, who could give me the information, the knowledge. You know, the internet wasn't as prolific as it is now. One didn't go to the internet, tap in, because you couldn't afford a computer then. Where can I get a loan to go to law school? You know, how do I convert my American qualifications and so forth? I eventually found out, I think it was NARIC, I forget what that acronym stands for, but some educational institution that told me that my American qualifications I needed to get an access to higher qualification. And I did that part-time for 2 years that then enabled me to go on to London Guildhall. And I started there part-time whilst working because I didn't have, you know, I was 20-ish, 21, 22 at that time. So completely independent. And my mother was still in America. So having to navigate my way through all of that, but that steel determination to continue to come out and be that voice.
But then you were told after all this effort, after all this commitment and work, you were told that it, for some reason your face didn't fit. I mean, how was that?
Yeah, so that was once I qualified in terms of, you know, consider a different profession. I think it's a lot of it was because I was quite social. I had a personality that some considered perhaps didn't suit the conservative legal profession. I also had, I remember doing a stint at the Citizens Advice Bureau. And when I went out to collect the client, the customer, the chap stood up and said, you know, well, you don't look like a solicitor, you know. So when I started to go grey, you know, that was kind of like, you know, I felt quite vindicated then that actually I'm a bit older, you know, and potentially look the part.
But when you were in law school, were there, I mean, it's changed a lot now, but were there very few students of colour at that time studying law? Certainly when I studied law, there were virtually none. And now, of course, there are many, many, many.
Yeah, so I went to Guildhall. I went to Guildford, and absolutely there was a handful of students who from an ethnic minority background. Notably, many of them came from the same institution. Most people, I think, at that time went to London because the affordability of travelling or having to find accommodation locally. I mean, it was fair to say that when I finished law school and I couldn't get work instantaneously, but my debt was greater between university and law school was greater, as some people told me, than their mortgage at that time. And no doubt that potentially, fast forward how many years, is still the same today with the introduction of tuition fees and taking inflation and cost into account.
Yeah. I think you just said at one point you worked as a postwoman and also for British Rail while you were studying.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, when I qualified as a solicitor, I hadn't found work, so I had all of this debt, and I did people's gardens.
So, as I say, you had a short time in private practice. I think you didn't really enjoy that. You found that a bit unsatisfying. So you then went in-house, and then, as I say, later on, began to become involved in the Law Society. And you described how, I think you used the words that the dynamics within the Law Society were changing. So this would be about, I think, 2013 when you joined the council. What did you mean by that? Did you mean more openness, more willingness to accept change and acknowledge the lack of diversity? Were those the kind of things?
Well, it was more so that the dynamics in the profession was changing. Right. And I didn't feel totally that was being represented within the council. So I had, as you rightly said, started in private practice, but was made redundant twice in as many years. And so, you know, things were changing. We could see the public legal funding that was being cut, lack of choice in terms of accessibility to advice, legal advice, and so forth. So that was what made me go in-house. And when I joined the council, I was one of a few who worked in-house. And I didn't feel that it was being sufficiently replicated. People weren't talking about in-house.
I mean, because it strikes me that your career trajectory would suggest that you developed an interest in policy and in public policy and in legal policy and found that more satisfying. And that's a route that many lawyers took, right? I took it myself briefly when I became DPP. I mean, there is something exciting about becoming involved in public policy and in legal policy, isn't there?
Well, absolutely. But if I think back to what drove me to enter the legal profession in the first place, what drives lots of us to enter the legal profession is that desire and wanting to help, you know, to assist people, support people with the advice. And I saw lots, and as we have seen over decades and decades, the erosion, the attrition of public funding, legal aid, people's inability to access justice. And going in-house did give me that exposure to more being closer to the decision making. I had a seat round the table. And so for me, wanting to ensure that the in-house community's voice was being heard on council was one of the reasons why I joined the council and put myself forward to become an office holder.
Because these, of course, were the difficult austerity years. I mean, your experience in 2013, that was the real kick in the teeth part of it all. When, I mean, you know, the CPS, for example, lost 30% of their funding, 30% of their lawyers, legal aid was slashed, legal aid eligibility disappeared in some areas, solicitors' firms went out of business, and we became familiar with the idea of legal aid deserts, whole parts of towns and parts of the country where there was simply no legal aid services available. So that was pretty big stuff for the Law Society. I mean, the Law Society doesn't just represent large corporate law firms. It's all about the delivery of legal services. So could you say a bit about what it was like grappling with those funding problems, those issues of austerity, and law being way down the pecking order? I mean, people would protect hospitals, obviously, but who wants to protect lawyers?
Well, absolutely. So when I first joined council, I remember one of my first meetings going along because an SGM, a special general meeting, had been called. And I think at that time, if memory serves me correctly, that the president at the time and the chief executive at the time, there were votes of there were to be votes of no confidence in them because of what was going on within the criminal justice sector. And of course, as I say, fast forward 10 or so years later, we're still seeing the issues still playing out.
Well, of course, you had the misfortune that your term of office from, I think it was March 2021 to October 2022, which is longer than is normal, I think, for a president of the Law Society. But your term of office had the misfortune to coincide with the period of office of Dominic Raab as the Lord Chancellor. He was sandwiched in between Robert Buckland and then briefly Brandon Lewis. And of course, subsequently now we have Alex Chalke.
But we like Robert Buckland because he's been on the podcast and he's a pretty decent guy. Raab, not so much.
And of course, today, Stephanie, by coincidence, I hadn't actually realised it until just before, the Law Society are in court. They're in the administrative court in front of Lord Justice Singh and Mr. Justice Jay, pursuing a judicial review of the failure of the Lord Chancellor to implement the or to provide the 15% increase in criminal legal aid fees that were granted after the bar strike last year, but denied to solicitors. I think solicitors were offered 9% with the promise of 2% more, I think, next year or 2025. So what I'm interested to get your view from the inside, leading the profession as you did, of what it was like dealing with Dominic Raab and the MOJ under his leadership.
Well, absolutely. I mean, it's fair to say that much of what was discussed, of course, is confidential, and I can't relay most of that. But absolutely, there was an independent criminal review undertaken. Sir Christopher Bellamy, as he was at the time, said that the solicitor profession, criminal defence solicitors, is in a parlous state. And what we saw was barristers being given the 15%. But as you've alluded to, solicitors were not given that 15%. They were given 9%. And that's almost a 40% reduction in terms of what barristers got and what solicitors were given. And when you think about it, if you are arrested, you're taken to a police station, it's solicitors that you will see who does the crux of that work.
I mean, one of the things I also wanted to ask you is the bar went on strike. They withdrew their services, but solicitors did not. What were the politics of that?
Well, it's not exactly the politics of it. It's that because of our professional obligations and our relationship with the legal aid agency, it meant, and that differs than the relationship that the barristers have, which probably they don't have one, but including a duty of care that starts with a solicitor's role at the police station for criminal cases, meant that solicitors could not go on strike. And so that was the reason we were not on strike. It's not because we didn't want to. And there were many members who contacted us to say that they wanted to. But it meant that going on strike would have potentially breached those contracts that many firms, criminal defence firms, held with the legal aid agency.
That's a bit feudal, isn't it? In one sense, because it's the idea of people who are working funded by a particular organisation, and because they have a contract, the people who are working don't have the right or the power to withdraw their labour, which is the best way to put pressure on an employer. I mean, the bar won their strike because they withdrew their labour. They won because the withdrawal of labour caused such chaos in the Crown Court, support the strike or not the support the strike, that's the effect of it. And the government couldn't tolerate any more of the damage, so they paid up. It's a bit... I mean, if I was a legal aid solicitor, I'd be a bit dissatisfied at the idea that I'm not allowed to go on strike. And I'm not sure... I mean, what would... If they had gone on strike, what would have been the consequences? I mean, legal aid authorities couldn't have stopped paying them once the strike was over. Presumably, things would have been patched up.
Well, the consequences would have been that a number of criminals would have been emboldened. The system, the criminal justice system, collapsing in its entirety, because going back to the example I gave earlier, that when you're arrested, you're taken to a police station, you have a legal right to receive legal advice. And if there's no one there to give that advice, because we were getting to a point where we were going to, the Law Society was going to come out and say that it is not financially worthwhile, viable for our members to continue to do this type of work. It still remains the case, and hence why the Law Society, as you said, is in the High Court today, in the Administrative Court, before the court, arguing this very point, is that it seems and appears that because strike action was taken, one group was rewarded, whilst another group, who for contractual reasons couldn't strike, was not rewarded. And what we say, of course, is that is not fair.
I suppose the reality is that if solicitors had refused to go to police stations to give advice, the police couldn't have charged anybody because people are entitled to legal advice in police stations. So you're right, obviously, the entire system would have collapsed. But the government were kind of using that as a threat to prevent the solicitors from going on strike. And the result is that the solicitors have ended up with 40% less than the barristers, which seems, as you say, seems very, very unfair.
Absolutely. And of course, we say it's a travesty, because if you look on year end, you know, for over a number of decades, what we have seen in real terms is some 26% cut in what criminal defence solicitors the rates of pay that they have been receiving. And to be clear, these are individuals who get out of, can be called out of their home, their beds at all times of evening. And there is a fixed rate that they're given. It's not, and you know, they're called into police stations and so forth, expected to give all types of advice at every hour, and they are not sufficiently being rewarded for it. And of course, what we've seen is that the number of people wanting to go into this type of work is seriously dropping off. And the average age of a duty solicitor is 50. It is not currently sustainable. Whatever the government's plan is, and I'm not clear what the government's plan is for our justice system, let alone our criminal justice system, other than the government being inactive and not coming out with a clear, transparent strategy, is that we cannot continue going the way that we're going.
Well, the statistics completely bear out what you're saying. I was looking up on the Law Society website, 1,652 law firms in 2012 did criminal legal aid, some 950, I think, today. And since 2017, huge numbers of solicitors have simply withdrawn from the duty solicitor scheme. Now, no doubt many criminal legal aid solicitors are waiting for the outcome of this judicial review. But if it fails, and of course it's a difficult, potentially difficult argument to succeed on, given the pressures on public funding generally and the broad discretion that may be given to the Lord Chancellor in those circumstances, I mean, the future would be very bleak, wouldn't it? Even worse than it's been over the last few years.
Well, absolutely. And so if I were still president, that's exactly what we'd be saying to, you know, our members, in as much that if it is not financially viable for you to continue to do this work, and we know it's not, because there have been other parts of the business, the firm, that has been propping up and subsidising legal aid work for the longest time. So we know it's not.
I mean, you spoke a moment ago, Stephanie, about government plans. I don't believe the government got any kind of plan at all for this, except to keep muddling through. It's got other priorities. It's focusing all its attention at the moment on trying to send 200 people to Rwanda. So I wouldn't imagine there's going to be any great improvement. Do you think the time has come to consider the possible fusion of the professions, solicitors and barristers? I mean, we're still separate, although the rules have been loosened greatly in recent years. Barristers can work in solicitors' practices, and some solicitors, I think, work in barristers' chambers. Do you think it's time to sweep away the distinction and to have a common legal profession?
I mean, absolutely. There is a distinction, a difference between what a solicitor does and what the barrister profession does. But I'm unclear as to what the advantage would be of fusing the professions, other than to potentially cause greater confusion amongst the public. The difficulty that we have, and when you talk about the priorities, and as people tell me all the time, that there is a lack of, there's no votes in the justice system. What we absolutely need to do is get the public, increase public legal literacy, get the public on side so that they understand that we are in such a state with our justice system, and that's not just in the criminal justice system that we speak lots of, but in the civil and the family courts and so forth, and the tribunals, that if the government does not get to grips with what is going on, and this is a justice system that is revered around the world.
Well, it was once. It should no longer be, in my view.
Well, absolutely. But of course, we still have the independence of the judiciary. We still have, in the most part, we still have, according to some, timely justice and so forth. But the public need to get behind this, and they need to, I call it the fourth emergency service, because without justice, without the ability to have an effective remedy, recourse to a court. As I say, that will embolden criminals. Our liberty, our property, everything is up for grabs.
One of the problems, of course, is the great unpopularity of lawyers, which is allied to another issue, which is the degree of misinformation out there about what we do and what our jobs are and what our responsibilities are. I mean, Tim and I have discussed with a number of guests over the last few months this modern habit of associating lawyers with the sins, perceived sins of their clients, so that lawyers are criticised for taking on cases. I mean, you could, examples would be kind of Russian oligarchs, but there are many others. I mean, the lawyer's response is always, look, everyone's entitled to legal counsel. And that's what the rule of law means. And we don't have groups of people who are not entitled to be represented or not entitled to representation. But how, speaking as a former president of the Law Society, how do we get across to a skeptical public the importance of this constitutional principle that everyone's entitled to representation and that lawyers are not responsible for the malfeasances of their clients?
In my view, it starts early, and it starts by teaching law, basic legal rights about the law in schools, that we're educating our younger citizens and adult citizens around our work and what we do. I was recently in a school speaking to sixth formers, and of course a young man put his hand up and said, you know, I don't want to be a lawyer because you're all corrupt, you know, and also that he had a real issue of having to represent, and because he didn't want to represent any paedophiles. And I explained to him that, you know, it's a slippery slope. We have to be careful around who we pick and choose to represent. And I know barristers are slightly more restricted than perhaps solicitors in terms of the cab rank rule and so forth. But the point is that it's through education. That is what is lacking. The media have the narrative on this. They have a free range on it. And when we are portrayed, of course, and we are portrayed not in the best light. And there are so many perceptions about us as lawyers that, you know, we're all fat cat lawyers. We all drive expensive cars, live in big houses and so forth. And of course, what the reality is for many, that is so far from the truth. And especially if you are a criminal defence solicitor or you are working in other sectors, immigration, family, other areas that are poorly paid, there are significant perceptions that is wrong. And that narrative needs to be corrected and arrested.
I want to come on next to, in a minute, to talk about the question of slaps and anti-slap measures. But on this question of public education and so on, I mean, obviously, you're right that a public education system which informs and educates people about the role of lawyers and the role of the justice system would be highly desirable. And, you know, here's hoping that with a Labour government, hopefully elected next year, that you'll have a team of people who are much more committed to the criminal justice system and the publicly funded, although the economics of it perhaps make even that...
We'll see what happens.
Well, I know. My point, I mean, the last decade has seen, according to the Law Society, a 77% drop in civil legal aid cases as a result of the cut. So we've already had a situation in which, as far as the public are concerned, in relation, forget crime, but in terms of civil legal aid...
It's a huge figure, isn't it?
It's incredible.
It's shocking.
I mean, the civil legal aid system, the one that Ken and I knew when we were starting practice in the 70s and 80s, I mean, it's just disappeared. There is no meaningful access to justice now, whether it's in the family courts or across the board.
And it's disappeared almost without public comment. I mean, it should be a great national scandal. Yeah.
That's my point.
Because the difficulty is that until you come to the law, until you have a legal issue, nobody thinks about the law. And that's my point about public legal education. I mean, I had somebody on the phone last night who said, you know, trying to navigate their way around the court system, trying to speak to a member of the court on the phone. Those days are almost far gone. Everything is done electronically. Technology has taken over or removed some of the human side to it as people are being pushed online. And unless you have a legal issue, most people do not think about the justice system. People say to me, it's not relevant and when you come to it at a point of trauma, either being arrested or divorced, or that's the wrong time to learn about the justice system, to learn about your rights. And of course, I've been very vocal and said legal rights mean absolutely nothing if you don't know what they are in the first place and you don't even know when they're being taken away.
Well, can we perhaps move finally, Stephanie, to this question of slaps? Because it's an issue that featured quite significantly during your period in office. And you were, I think, quoted when you were president that you stressed the need for a strengthening and clarification of the rules relating to SLAPs. And just for those who don't not aware of the acronym, SLAP stands for Strategic Litigation Against Public Participation, and is used to describe litigation brought on behalf usually of extremely wealthy individuals against journalists and others seeking to exercise free expression and investigative journalism, particularly into issues of corruption and other forms of criminality.
Just to add, Tim, they're cases that are brought, by the definition, not really to win a legal cause, but simply to frighten, bully, and shut up the other side.
Yeah, while you were in office, the Law Society confirmed that it supports judiciary-led gatekeeping with regard to litigation with SLAP-like tendencies, robust changes to the civil procedure rules, more rigorous case and cost management by the courts, and limiting costs by considering a range of options. I was interested just to ask you, first of all, of course, the Law Society is, in fact, the trade union of solicitors, so you're there as the trade union leader to some extent.
I was just about to say, absolutely. We like to see ourselves as the representative body, the professional body, rather than the trade union.
Yes, I understand. I would use the same about the Bar Council. I regard the Bar Council as the barristers' trade union.
Tim's from Wales, so, you know, the expression trade union is not an insult in his... in his lexicon.
It's absolutely not. Absolutely not. but I suppose my point, Stephanie, is this. You have to negotiate or navigate your way through the role of defending solicitors from unfair allegations of SLAP conduct, as well as a matter of principle, putting forward proposals on legislative reform. I mean, was that a difficult balance to strike?
Well, I mean, given the context at the time, and lots of this was around parliamentarians coming out very publicly under the veil of parliamentary privilege, naming certain individuals, solicitors and firms in Parliament. And some of that was taken, and rightly so, as we came out and said, we welcome that. But let's be clear that there was and is rigorous professional standards and rules that we have to, as solicitors, adhere to, wrapped in integrity and so forth in the first place. And of course, the Solicitors Regulation Authority, the regulatory body, has issued further guidance. But what we were concerned about was that the right balance had to be struck between the freedom of speech and unintended consequences that this may have on individuals and the right to representation and so forth.
I mean, it's an interesting question, isn't it? I'm sure there are some cases that are SLAPs. Indeed, there was one recently that was stopped in the High Court. But sometimes people who have defamed other people start shouting SLAP as soon as the solicitor's letters arrive. And I don't know whether you were present at the time, but the Solicitors Regulation Authority did do an examination of this question and did some spot checks of files in firms that do media work and didn't really come up with any convincing examples of SLAPs, which would suggest that they're not as widespread as the media sometimes suggests. The media, of course, have a big interest in identifying cases as SLAPs because often the so-called SLAPs are directed against journalists and newspapers who have, on the face of it, defamed people. So they don't come to this with entirely clean hands.
Absolutely. And of course, the government's position at the time was exactly that, is that, you know, freedom of speech, you know, journalists should not be stopped from reporting on certain cases, individuals and so forth. And of course, we have had the government bring forward legislation, not in, you know, not a standalone legislation in terms of SLAPs, but wrapped up in the Economic Crime and Corporate Transparency Act. And there are a number of bodies that continue to push for standalone legislation when it comes to SLAPs. But again, it goes back to my point around the narrative that's being played out, a lack of understanding by individuals, including parliamentarians, who stood up very vocally, publicly, under the parliamentary veil and said and outed people. And that comes with consequences.
Well, it's very damaging for the individuals to be accused that way by people who cannot face any consequences for making the allegations, whether they're true or false. I mean, parliamentary privilege has to be used with great, great care. Otherwise, it can become an abuse in itself.
Exactly. And people's safety and health was put at risk. So, you know, and some groups took to plastering posters in very public places with individuals' names, telephone numbers and addresses. So one has to be careful as to who is named and accused of undertaking this type of litigation.
Well, Stephanie, thank you very much for joining us today. It's been an interesting tour through the issues that are facing the solicitors profession. I'm sorry that perhaps our conversation has not been more optimistic, but we live in difficult times, as you know only too well from your period in office. And here's hoping that the Law Society win this judicial review. I suppose we'll have judgment now in the new year. Perhaps we'll get you back on at a time to see where things are in a few months' time. But Stephanie, many, many thanks for joining us, and we wish you all the best.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you very much for joining us, Stephanie. Last time we were on the verge of what appears to be a Labour government, the great slogan was things can only get better. I'm not quite so sure we're all merrily singing that in 2023. But thank you so much for joining us, and we wish you all the best. Thank you, Steph. Well, thank you for joining us for this episode of Double Jeopardy. As Tim said earlier, it's the last of this year, so we wish you a very happy Christmas, happy New Year. We'll see you in the new year. In the meantime, if you haven't listened to all of our 43, 44, 45 odd podcasts, they're all there available. We have a wonderful back catalogue, great luminaries of the legal and political world, so you can dip in and out of that over the holidays. Have a good holiday, and we'll see you in the new year.
Our editor, as ever, is Billy Lawrence, to whom many, many thanks. And our social media editor or advisor is Jess Jones, to whom we also say a big thank you. And we'll see you next year.